This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On a Friday at the semi-official end of summer, this semi-hypothetical question: is it the economy that's a mess, or just us, the humble consumer? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 29th of August by my calendar. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Not that we necessarily needed it, but we were reminded today of the truism that sometimes capitalism just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The reminder came in the form of two reports on the consumer economy, whence, as you know, something like 70% of all economic activity is derived. Report number one, we learned today consumer spending fell 0.1% in July. Not huge, and there are some caveats, but still, you know, worth a note. Also, for your consideration, report number two, the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index that measures how people feel right now about the economy. It has hit its highest level since before the recession. Its highest level. So, what gives? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
We did close our wallets a bit in July, but that's partly because we paid less for utilities and gas, says Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight.
That can be a good thing in many cases if you have a smaller electricity bill at the end of the month.
Still, add those mediocre income gains in July, which has been the pattern for years for all but the highest earners, and it all points to a still weak economic recovery. Then why are we consumers so upbeat, feeling better than we have since 2007? Mark Vittner at Wells Fargo says actually we weren't feeling too great about the economy or our jobs and paychecks back then either.
So the fact that we're the highest that we've been in 7 years, it's good. It means that we're better off than where we were a year ago or 2 years ago. But it still doesn't compare to where we would be if economic conditions were truly great.
I checked all this with consumer Sarai St. Julian. I met her in a grocery store parking lot in Portland, Oregon.
I feel more confident, but still aware I have to be careful. We got hit pretty hard. My husband lost his job, and we kind of had to put ourselves back together and sold a lot of personal belongings to do it. We are doing better. He's got a good job, but we're still, I think, sort of digging out of a hole.
Doing better, but still digging out of a hole. A mantra for the economy circa late summer 2014. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The discussion of that economy circa late summer, the end of summer, if you will, 2014, continues now with Neela Richardson from Redfin, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. They are in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So let me ask you first, Neela, about that thing Mitchell said early on in this piece, mediocre income gains. Part of what's going on here is the consumers are just stuck, not making a whole lot more money.
Yeah, wages aren't increasing very much, if they're increasing at all. And there is some new research out there that says wages may not increase for a long time, that employers were reticent to actually drop them during the recession. And so they're not going to raise them now that we're recovering. So that's still going to be a condition going forward.
Cardiff, let me ask you about something else Mitchell said. One of the guys in his piece said, we are not where we would be if the economy were going strong, that is, if the recession had never happened. There is ground here that was lost that will not be made up consumer-wise.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big worries. And, you know, in some way, this is all very straightforward. It's the combination both of long-term and short-term trends. The short-term trend, if you want to call it that, I guess now, is that it's just been such a weak recovery from a really terrible recession. But I would point out that even before the recession in the last 15 years or so, there's also a distribution issue. We've got an inequality, an income inequality
right.
issue where, you know, obviously the people who are making a lot of money, you know, they feel pretty good because things keep getting better. But people a little bit further down the scale aren't doing quite as well. And so until the economy itself gets stronger and there's more demand for jobs, it's going to be hard for people to get big wage gains because they just can't negotiate.
Yeah.
I think the key words here are confident but careful. The savings rate is up, but people are still very careful because they don't know what's around the corner.
Let me ask you, though, Neela, to pick up on a thing that Cardiff alluded to. The economy is growing, right? This week we got a GDP revision of 4.2% at an annual rate in the most recent quarter. Yet companies still aren't hiring. Wages are stuck. There is a big-ish disconnect.
There's a big disconnect, and a lot of that growth is just making up ground for a really terrible first quarter that got pushed to the second quarter. And since I work in D.C., I can be cynical and say in time for the midterm elections. but some of that was actually good because we did see some increases in private investment. Companies are starting to invest a bit more. The consumer has been carrying the weight of the economy for a long time, and we're still waiting for the businesses to pick up the slack. We started to see that in the second quarter.
All right, Cardiff, slight change of gears here. Speaking about companies investing, let's talk about specifically investors, venture capital investors investing. Snapchat, that company that makes pictures that go away in like nanoseconds or, you know, less than 10 seconds, whatever, is worth somehow $10 billion. Look at that and then look at where the stocks are and tell me we're not in a bubble. Come on.
So I'm definitely hesitant to start using the word bubble just yet. And in some ways, it's kind of arbitrary when you do start to use it. But the problem is that it implies that there's like this big dangerous issue going on where if these companies don't work out, then, you know, there'll be this catastrophic failure. Whatever.
But this company doesn't make any money.
That's true, but there's always companies that people get overinvested in. It's very popular, by the way. And so the issue here is that it doesn't just have to start making money at some point. It also might be attractive to other bigger companies that like the technology. And so it's hard to say this stuff in advance. Remember, when Microsoft invested in Facebook at a valuation of like $15 billion, everybody thought they were crazy. Now it's at like close to $200 billion. So, you know, these things are hard to work out in advance. There's always some companies that are overvalued, some that are undervalued. That's just the market.
All right. Fair enough. Neela, let me get to you quickly with a question about geopolitics and what's going on. ISIS, Iraq, Russia, Ukraine, and yet we here in this country seem relatively immune. How come?
Well, I think we are in some cases geographically isolated from it, even though we do have a lot of interest abroad. But also, you know, in terms of our economy, when things get rough around the world, there's a flight to quality to the United States. So where that shows up is in our interest rates. They're still really low, Kai. And so if you go get a mortgage, if you go get an auto loan, if you're trying to do something that has to do with an interest rate, what you see is a very low price. That's actually good news in spite of all the global disconnectedness out there.
Neela Richardson from Redfin. She is in Washington, D.C., not in New York, as I said. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphaville. He is, unless I'm wrong again, in New York, right, man?
Yep.
All right, good.
That's right.
See you guys later. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Ahead of that 3-day weekend, Wall Street was in a buying mood. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Keeping on going with that overseas theme here for a second, the international commodities market can be a curious place full of little mysteries that make you go, huh, I wonder what's up there. Here's one that we saw on Bloomberg today. Why would a big Wall Street bank, Morgan Stanley by name, buy up a whole bunch of European diesel fuel, especially when there's a glut of the stuff? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has been trying to figure out why.
The experts will tell you nobody knows for sure, but they can guess. Here's one guess. Somebody's worried that the conflict between Russia and the Ukraine will stop the flow of gas to Europe by wintertime when demand goes up. Yeah, and what does it have to do with diesel? Phil Flynn of the Price Futures Group spins it out.
If they can't find natural gas, they're going to have to find alternatives. You know, they're going to have to use more coal. They're going to have to use more oil.
And maybe some more diesel. So buy low now, sell high later. Unless prices don't go up, then you lose money. That's called trading naked when you do it with your own money. Energy consultant David Bellman thinks that's unlikely. Instead, Morgan Stanley may be acting as an agent for end users like governments or companies.
It could be agents to multiple people. They could have found that, you know, end user A, end user B, end user C, and they got them and negotiated with all of them to say, hey, aren't you concerned about Ukraine?
Or it could be a lot simpler than that. Phil Verleger is an energy economist and consultant, and he looked up diesel prices and the price of diesel futures while we talked. You can sell a contract today to deliver diesel in January for a little more than the current price.
They could buy the diesel, store it, sell futures against it, and earn a very nice return at a time when interest rates are essentially zero.
In this case, it's the storing it that's the hard part for most players because of the glut. If Morgan Stanley has some storage capacity, that's what allows the bank to make money by buying something nobody else wants. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Abercrombie & Fitch, the retailer known for its sexy, some would say inappropriately sexy models, and for its clothes that scream Abercrombie, is ditching its logo. From now on, the company says its clothes will be logo-free, at least in North America, which is funny when you think about it, because for years, one of the biggest reasons to buy Abercrombie was to let everybody know that you were wearing Abercrombie. But times and tastes change, as Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains.
Once upon a time, teens loved big, huge logos, and Abercrombie led the charge. But no surprise, teens are fickle. Barbara Kahn is a marketing professor at Wharton.
In general, I think there is a trend that kids are not as into logos as they once were because there's more of an emphasis on showing your own individuality.
But Kahn says it also depends on the logo. And right now, Abercrombie's is out of fashion with kids. Ronnie Moaz, an analyst at Standpoint Research, says the fast fashion trend has created a big shift in the teen clothing industry. For one thing, it's knocked Abercrombie off its perch.
I downgraded the stock in early July.
Moaz says retailers like Forever 21 and H&M are putting out the newest fashions quickly and cheaply.
Abercrombie, you're paying $50, $60, $70 for a dress. At H&M, it's $20.
And there's no logo, so kids can mix and match and feel like they're creating their own individual style. While this is good news for kids, CBN Siegel, an analyst at Nomura, says it's bad news for retailers.
Leaving the brand premium means your pricing power probably erodes, right?
And Siegel says it's not just Abercrombie, but all teen retailers that have relied on brands in the past. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
One of the big messages on college campuses as students head back to school is about preventing sexual assault. The federal government has been cracking down on colleges for their handling or non-handling of sexual assault cases, and more than 70 schools are currently under investigation. That, in turn, is creating a business opportunity for companies with products and services aimed at protecting students and their universities. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
There's the nail polish that can detect date rape drugs when you dip your fingers into a drink, and a whole bunch of smartphone apps that let students easily notify friends or campus police if they get into a scary situation. One fast-growing app is called LiveSafe.
When Ava saw a suspicious man on campus, she alerted campus police in real time using LiveSafe's mobile app.
That's from a promotional video for LiveSafe, which is being used at schools including Georgetown and Arizona State. Schools pay anywhere from a few bucks per student on up for the services. Estimates say that as many as 80% of sexual assaults on college campuses go unreported. LiveSafe Chief Executive Jenny Abramson thinks apps like hers can help change that.
We find that in a number of places we're in, they're getting twice as many or even some places 10 times as many tips from a student to the safety official around things that they wouldn't normally share.
In addition to entrepreneurs like Abramson, lots of consultants and lawyers are marketing videos and training programs around sexual assaults. They're betting schools would rather pay their fees than face much stiffer penalties from the government. Without the proper programs in place, colleges can jeopardize federal funding and get fined hundreds of thousands of dollars. Peter Lake is a campus safety expert at Stetson University College of Law. He says the greater the scrutiny, the bigger the business opportunities.
With a heavily regulated industry, you're going to see a lot of products and services offered.
Stetson says many schools aren't set up to deal with these new rules.
I mean, a lot of us were using coconuts and Dixie cups with string to communicate, and now we have complicated software programs that actually work to get data in real time.
But Dana Bolger, who was a rape victim in college and is now an activist, is worried the technology may be more dazzling than effective.
These products, while often well-intentioned, tend to lull us into a false sense of security, as if we can just innovate our way out of systemic violence against women.
Bolger says what's really important in the big push to prevent sexual assaults is teaching students what consent means. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up, you think your apartment is small?
Well, I can tell you, we just built a hotel and the rooms were bigger for the hotel than this apartment. This is very small.
But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. On the last working day of the month, the Dow Industrial is up 18 points, a 10%, closed at 17,098. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, a 0.5%. 4580. The S&P 500 up 6 points, a 3rd percent, finished at 2003. For the week that was, the Dow up 0.6%, the NASDAQ up 0.9%, the S&P 500 gained 0.7%. Chip company Avago rose 7.5% to down better than expected quarterly results. Software maker Splunk spiked 19% after its earnings beat expectations. Come on, that's just fun to say, Splunk. Apple sweetened 0.25%, boosted by the buzz over that new iPhone next month. You know, maybe, sort of, probably. Carmaker Tesla revved up 2.2%. Today it reached a deal with China Unicom to have charging stations at its stores in 100 Chinese cities. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. This day in 1939 marked the beginning of World War II, as Nazi Germany invaded Poland. President Obama is scheduled to speak at Labor Fest in Wisconsin, but the U.S. financial markets are taking the day off in observance of Labor Day. And let's start the week off right. It's International Enthusiasm Week. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are, as of right now, 67 days until Election Day, and then the heavy lifting really starts, the run for the White House in 2016. Between now and then, we are going to see billions and billions and, yes, billions of dollars spent on what the political professionals call messaging. They're going to look a whole lot like campaign ads, but technically, they're not. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Last week, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, kicked off a multi-million dollar ad campaign with a 30-second spot.
Liberals call this flyover country. It's an insult. But nobody insults your life like this guy, Michael Bloomberg, billionaire, elitist, hypocrite.
The NRA says Bloomberg has declared war on the organization and its 5 million members.
Hey, Bloomberg, keep your politics in New York and keep your hands off our guns and our freedom.
The former mayor of New York has pledged to spend at least $50 million pushing for more background checks on gun buyers. But Bloomberg is out of office. He's not running for anything, at least right now. And according to Michael Franz, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, that's what makes the NRA's campaign so novel.
To see him be the target of the ad is in many ways something we've never seen before.
In the past, attack ads have tied politicians to other politicians and donors to their campaigns. We've seen that with the Koch brothers and Tom Steyer. But Franz says he believes this is the first ad not tied to a candidate or a campaign.
This is the post-Citizens United world that we live in.
He and others say it's hard to overstate how much the landscape has changed over the last few years. Danilo Janic is a professor of public policy at the University of Delaware.
The way we've organized now since Citizens United, essentially everything is on the table.
Everything and everyone. Ken Goldstein is a political science professor at the University of San Francisco. He says Michael Bloomberg and other big donors are being cast as outsiders.
The message here is that there's something improper about these people being involved in politics, that their money is trying to fool you.
It's an update, Goldstein says, of a technique campaign operatives have used for a long time.
One of the first things one does in opposition research is see if they can tie the other side to someone who is unsavory or unpopular.
What the NRA is hoping, Goldstein says, is that this ad and others it plans to run nationwide will affect how Americans see Michael Bloomberg and the cause he backs. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A couple of points about the rental economy as a way to set up this next story. First of all, rents, especially in urban areas, are higher now than they were before the recession. Number two, figures from the Census Bureau show that more and more people are moving to cities, which then pushes those rents up even more. Cities all over the place are trying to figure out how to deal with that problem. And one experiment that's getting a whole lot of play is something called the micro unit. Marketplace's Sabri Minashour has that story.
Being young and single, living in New York City is a dream for many people. This, however, is often the reality. Marco Sanchez lives on the third floor of this brown, brick, industrial-looking building in the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn.
This building used to be a warehouse.
There's some pretty cool graffiti of yellow jellyfish in the stairwell. The ceilings are at least 12 feet high. Painting supplies cover one room. There's an old film crane in another. Sanchez lives here with his roommates.
Over here is Colin's room, Philip's room. This is where Co lives.
All eight of them.
Farah. That's Levi and Michelle. Miles. Nine people, five cats, and then a number of regulars who are guests.
Marco says this place and the people here are awesome, and the rent is around $900, which is almost as cheap as it gets in New York. But there is another price to pay, because no matter how awesome his roommates are, there's still up to 15 of them.
You hear sex through the walls. You hear some bathroom noises. There are frequently dirty dishes in the sink. The cats are really nice, but I think they're gross. When I have my lotto fantasies, one of the first things I do is I get a place on my own near my job.
Roommates can get old.
Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology at NYU and author of Going Solo.
Contemporary people, given the option, would rather go solo, which is why we see such incredible demand in the real estate market.
He says more people are living alone than at any time in the history of our species, and there's still not enough housing to meet demand.
The problem is that real estate has become so expensive in the central urban areas that many people are just priced out of the rental market.
A one-bedroom in Manhattan easily goes for $3,000 a month or more. But it's not just that there's a lot of demand. There's a mismatch between what kind of housing people are demanding and what is available.
In most of these cities, the population of singles, and certainly of singles and couples, far exceeds the numbers of studios and one-bedrooms.
John Infranca is a research affiliate at NYU's Furman Center. In many cities, not just New York, the available housing is 50 to 70 years old on average, and it was designed for a different era.
We had more large families, oftentimes people not living on their own until they started their own family.
Infranca says this means today families are actually paying a price for the lack of housing for singles.
The demand for housing of this population is currently being met instead by our stock of two- and three-bedroom units. And in so doing, is really pricing families out of those units because they're having to compete with, you know, two or three single individuals.
One possible solution is taking shape in the Brooklyn Navy Yard inside an immense factory space.
And this is the combined living dining area. Kitchen goes back in this corner.
Tom O'Hara is with Capsys. They build modular residences, prefabricated, stackable, or movable dwellings. On this construction line is a prototype for what is called a micro unit. It's a mini apartment. It'll be part of an apartment building in Manhattan. And this micro unit is very micro.
This is about 300 square feet.
The kitchen island will fold down from the wall. The bed will either be a Murphy bed or a convertible sofa.
Well, I can tell you, we just built a hotel, and the rooms were bigger for the hotel than this apartment. This is very small.
But, says O'Hara, that is the point.
I don't know that anyone would live in a space this big in Peoria, but in New York City, you have a space like this because you live in the city. And this is where you take a shower and sleep.
In dense cities, people live their lives outside. The coffee shop down the street, the bar around the corner, or at least that is the bet that a lot of cities are beginning to make, from Austin to Denver to Washington, D.C., as they allow developers to experiment with building microunits. Again, John Infranca with NYU's Furman Center.
These units are renting out very quickly, if not fully rented at the moment that construction is finished.
So in terms of meeting a clear demand, Infranca says the experiment has been a clear success.
The broader issue, though, of course, is do they represent good urban planning?
In Seattle, microunits as small as 120 square feet have been built in not very dense parts of the city. Some residents worry about parking problems. On the other hand, if young people or single people can't move to a city because there's nowhere affordable to live the way they want, that city becomes less attractive.
To really study that, we would need to have more of these developments going in.
Manhattan is getting 55 microunits in the next several months. The rent will range from $900 on up. Some may go for as much as $2,000 a month, which may sound expensive, but for some people, not doing your roommate's dishes is priceless. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note today, one of those studies, he says, using air quotes, ranking one thing or another. They are quirky, yes, but also sometimes interesting. WalletHub, the personal finance website, has taken a whole bunch of data points, age, gender, income, and household makeup among them, and ranked cities on how typically American they are. That is, how close they are to the national average. Number one, Nashville, Tennessee. Number 340, by the way, out of 366 on the list, Washington, the District of Columbia, the nation's capital city. All right, we're done. That's it. That's Marketplace on this Friday. Today, the Dow up 18 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 22 points, a half percent. The S&P 500 put on 6 points, a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.